Fine Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. I got some news that'll help. Lots of stuff going on right now. This is that happening month. This is the, we are right here on the cusp of the next season. Gulf summer's over, really. I think probably within a day or two, I think it's probably going to be safe to say, no more than 5 days, it's going to be safe to say that Gulf summer is done. Gulf summer is that... It's that season along the Gulf Coast and throughout Alabama, even. When thunderstorms develop locally, in places like on the Gulf Coast, they develop just about every day, very close to Mobile. Very rainy. The temperatures are a little suppressed often, particularly along the Gulf Coast when those storms come up. But now we're coming in, and let me introduce you to a man, a fellow, a thing, named Fred. So Fred is kind of ushering in the next season. Let's call it Hurricane Summer. It's the season of hurricane flowers. We have lots of them along the Gulf Coast. We used to call them hurricane lilies. We have, but we commemorate that season. Of hurricanes with the plants that bloom during that season. And it will last from August 15th, August 20th, through about October 15th, October 20th. The hurricanes then are less of a threat. Not gone entirely, but less of a threat. Just like hurricanes are rare in June and July, they happen, but they're rare. They're rare after the end of hurricanes. But it's coming up. And what's going to happen is we're going to get less rainfall every day. The rainfall is going to be much less dependable. One of the things that happens is Fred may... It's got to draw all the rainfall to it. It's just like, I don't know. In my mind, this is not literally what happens. And weather forecasters will call me and say, oh, you're full of it. But, you know, in my mind, these hurricanes, they just kind of go up and they just pull all the rain with them. You know, all the potential rainfall just kind of gets dragged out through the hurricanes. And depending on where the hurricane is, those areas are going to get tons of rainfall. The rest of the areas are going to be pretty dry. And that's the way it works. Mobile, for example, may end up pretty dry from Fred if it continues to move farther east. Kind of depend on where you are. Those in West Alabama are probably not going to get a lot of rainfall here out of this hurricane. So it's a different, very different season. The temperatures are going to go up. So one of the things about hurricane summer is that because there are fewer clouds, and because we may have more sunny days, the temperatures are going to go up. I'll tell you another thing that's going to happen. I love the light. Light in August, as Mr. Faulkner would say. Light in August. It's special in the South. Late August, early September, the light just becomes, I don't know what it is. It's just incredible. Incredible light. Sometimes still a little too intense in midday, but by the evenings, as we get in the afternoons, after 2 or 3, that light is just incredible. It's going to be a beautiful time. Let me tell you how I'm going to help you here. I think some of you may be ahead of me. I can't help you. I can try to catch up with you, but I can't help you. Here's the thing. We need to prepare for fall. In hurricane summer, we need to prepare for fall just like some people prepare for spring. It's like getting a jump on spring. You've heard people talk about that with their tomatoes. How do I get a jump on spring? Well, you know, it's just as important. It's just as important in Alabama, along the Florida Gulf Coast, in Mississippi. It's just as important to get a jump on fall. because fall is this great season of time when we're growing kale and collards and cabbage and carrots, all those great seeds. Boy, there's a bunch of seeds. Yeah, fava beans. All those things. Arugulas, broccolis, all those wonderful things we can grow for months, mustard greens, for months. October, we'll be harvesting them easily from October, November, December, January, February, into March. That's a long season and a lot of produce, but we got to get them in now. And the sooner we get them in, things like parsley, the sooner we get them in and get them started, get them going in the garden, things like broccoli, the more we can harvest over winter, because the days do get shorter, particularly around late mid-November. Days are getting really short. And so you want these plants to be ready to produce by at least the 1st of November. And you want them to preferably to be budding up, because that's when the days are still long enough that they get plenty of light, temperatures, and they'll keep pumping through the winter if that happens. So, but you got to get an early start. And I got to say, bugs is real. Insect damage is real this time of year. It's real. It ain't theoretical. It's going to happen. And I'm sitting out here looking and I'm thinking, I need to plant my collards. I'm ready to plant all these collards that I'm falling in love with. And I'm looking at last year's collards, which are surviving, but they are being eaten into skeletons. Eaten into skeletons right now by the harlequin bugs. You may not have harlequin bugs. Not everybody does, but they're out there. You know, there's lots of other bugs. There's lots of cabbage worms that are going to show up. If you're planting turnips, you're going to get the yellow margin beetle. The grasshoppers, for some people, are a bad deal. Shoot, I got rabbits. I got rabbits that got feathers. Oh, goodness gracious. Chickens. You know, I was going to shoot a rabbit. I got so mad at that rabbit. And then I looked, and it's the dadgum chickens with the feathers over there. But I do have rabbits as well. All these things are going to be a problem now, and we need to start planning. Ellen's got her broccoli ready to go. She's got it up. It's going. But we got to get it in the ground, not a little early for most of it, particularly in South Alabama, particularly along the Gulf Coast. But how are we going to deal with it when we get it in the ground? Because some of these bugs are still going to be bad. So, preparing for fall, getting a jump on fall, there's lots of ways to do it. One is the ground's going to be a little bit hot. Some seeds aren't going to germinate as well. You're going to have to water the ground before you sow the seeds. Just always a reminder, this time of year, you probably need to water the ground before you sow the seeds. It also doesn't hurt to have a mulch. But let me tell you about what that mulch should look like. You want to keep the ground really cool this time of year. You want to keep it cool. But you don't want to have too much of a layer for the seeds to come up through. So one of the things I do this time of year is like I take break pine boughs, small tips of pine branches, just lay them over where I do the seeds. It allows plenty of air circulation around the seeds, allows some light to come through, but it keeps the ground cooler, and the smell of those pines probably also discourage some insects as the seedlings are coming up. Nice little thing. But there's another thing that I'm doing, and I need you to hear me, because it is. I realized, boy, I don't know why I didn't do this sooner. It makes so much sense. I guess I don't like contraptions, and I thought this was contraption. And then I realized it's not really contraption. It's just very simple. It's mosquito netting. It's the simplest, smartest thing you could possibly do. Isn't that incredible? You know, people used to hang mosquito netting around their beds at night where they sleep. And it's still a cool thing. They sell it for all sorts of purposes. You know, I was looking at some mosquito netting the other day, and somebody said, you could even make a wedding dress out of this. Well, sure, you could make a wedding dress out of this, particularly if the mosquitoes are bad at your wedding. But mosquito netting really works on a lot of the pests that we're encountering this time of year. And I bought some, and it's working, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it. Getting a jump on fall, that's what we're doing right now. We're enjoying this season hurricane summer, but we're getting a jump on fall. This is the time of year for planting. Hey, give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106.
How the weather in the Delta, how the food tastes in your mouth.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that's where all we come tiptoe. Through the tulips,
come on.
With me.
Okay. Turn it down. There you go. Thank you. Tiny. That's it. That's out. That's no more. Not this show. We got it done. It's past us. Rest of the show is going to be great. So, talking about this fabric. You know, insect netting's really good, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it when we come back. It's really important this time of year, and I just want to talk about, I'm going to talk to you about how to get that fabric, because Cookie's calling. And we're going to talk about how to get that kind of fabric, how to get the right kind of fabric. Let's talk about it now. So, you know, basically, you're going to have to go on Amazon, look for mosquito netting or bug netting, or, you know, now that, because they're always marketing it for whatever purpose that they think they ought to purpose it right at this moment, they got it cicada netting. Because up, you know, in the Northwest, they got cicadas right now, or Northeast. Or Atlantic Coast, at any rate. So, it's going to have several names, but it's basically a netting that is designed to keep mosquitoes out, but also other bugs. And sometimes they're designed for bugs in particular, gardens in particular. They're usually made out, and it's a really loose weave, which means that it doesn't trap heat, which is important. And letting light through is pretty important. And so, you know what I did? It's working, man. It's working so well. My word, why have I waited so long to get carrots? So my carrots are getting eaten up by who knows what. Rabbits, grasshoppers, whatever can get to them. And getting the carrots up is a challenge in and of itself. That's why those little pine boughs helped. Watering the ground helped. Making sure that I got putting those pine boughs on there, and then putting the pine boughs, and then dropping this mosquito netting over it. Man, they're doing great. They're getting plenty of light. They don't need to get a lot of light intensity this time of year. The netting doesn't heat the ground up, which is important. You don't want to heat the ground anymore. And some netting will. Some netting will trap heat. This traps it a little bit, but not too bad. Not too bad. Allows rain to come through. Allows water to come through easily. Beautiful. My carrots are doing great. You know, I got broccoli. I'm going to put it out. Pretty soon, cabbage. I'm going to put it out. And I know the worms are going to be there, but you know the moths can't get to it. Moths can't get to it at all. Pickerel weed. Pickerel moths. You know, pickle. Pickerel weed. Pickle worms. Excuse me. You know, we've been talking a little bit about that lately. But you want to deal with pickle worms? There's really a really great way of dealing with it, and that is the pickle worm moth flies at night. So if you've got squash, you got cucumbers, whatever the pickle worm is affecting, you can put that netting over your plants at night. Take it off during the day because they need pollination during the day. They need insects, but the moths are only going to be flying at night. You can make a big difference in pickle worms. Of course, you got to start it earlier. But, you know, if you've just started planting squash, you got some summer squash, you want to give it a try? Sounds great. I think some folks did. You know what I'd do? I'd throw that mosquito netting, that bug netting, that garden netting over those plants as soon as they start to develop flowers. Just before they start to develop flowers. You can just put it on them before they develop flowers. And then when those flowers begin to develop, pull it off during the day and leave it on during night. Incredible stuff. I don't know why. I'll tell you, you know, it just takes me a while sometimes to catch on. But mosquito netting works really well, and it's working really well for me. It's going to work on a lot of my winter vegetables. There it is. Floating row covers are a little different, and we'll talk about that. And I had less success with the floating row covers because they trap too much heat and they're too fragile. And the mosquito, if they don't trap heat, they're too fragile. If they're pretty sturdy, they trap too much heat and too much sunlight. So I'm not using the floating row covers, which I use for other reasons. So, interesting thing. We can talk more about it. Hey, one thing I got to talk about, which is the picture that I got from, Gary. Oh, Gary, have I got some music for you at the end of this session. I want you to listen to that music. And if that don't explain it, then I gotta do a little dog and pony about one of the South's great former problematic vegetables. One of my great grandmother's favorite wild native foods. But we'll talk. You gotta listen. You gotta listen for the cue. You gotta listen for the key. It's coming at the end of this segment. Yeah, it's going to tell you a lot about what you need to know, and then we'll come back and look at it and figure that out. So when do I recommend, Glenn's saying, when do I recommend planting winter plants, not seeds? That all depends on which they are, and we're going to talk about that. I will promise to talk about that when we come back in the next segment. After 30, as I would like to say, in that next 30-minute segment, we're going to talk again about all the different vegetables that we need to plant. David, I'm listening. What kind of tree survey have you got?
Well, first of all, I think you played tiny on purpose because I think you saw my name. I was like, David would appreciate that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I've tried to conjure you up because, you know, I hadn't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, well, I got a piece of mail in the mail this week, and it looks all official, like it might be from the Forestry Commission or something. And I opened it up, and it's a tree survey from the National Arbor Day Foundation. And I was calling to ask you, is there anything of value above and beyond the fundraising efforts of that organization to fill out and send in that tree survey?
No, but the paper is very useful for starting fires. So If you've got, when you're trying to get your coal started, I recommend it works really well. National Arbor Day Foundation takes money and doesn't use it for really great purposes. And they send people trees that don't do well in their climate. I find their mission problematic.
So basically, you just save it for the winter when the Labor Day barbecue to start the charcoal grill, basically.
That's right. And so now you can begin to, it's a signal to start planning what you're going to put on the grill. When I get those surveys, it says, now what am I going to put on the grill? And that's a good reminder.
Understand the irony of the number of trees they had to kill to get the responses that they wanted for that survey.
Right. And one of the good things is, then you can also start thinking about what kind of tree am I going to use to put on the grill? And of course, the ideal tree, one of the ideal trees for putting on the grill, along with that paper from the National Arbor Day Foundation, is Bradford pears. Great, great smoking wood. Wonderful smoking wood. Probably not as good as apple. A little different in hickory and pecan, but it's a good smoking wood. Bradford pears, great thing to chop up. Just torture it. You know, find a Bradford pear and start torturing it.
Well, that's good to know. I prefer freshly picked green pecan wood myself.
Freshly picked what?
Green pecan wood.
Oh, yeah. That works, too. That works, too. Can you get it to burn?
It's difficult, but I got my secrets.
All right, all right, all right.
All right, have a good one.
David, thank you. So, Cookie, you want to talk about Tool? So Cookie was asking, I think, about Tool, and my suspicion is, and Cookie, I may have misread, but I think one of the questions is, does Tool work? Tool is a T-U-L-L-E. If I mispronounce it, forgive me, but I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't use a lot of Tool. I use tools, but not Tool. Which is a type of fabric that is often used in, I guess, wedding dresses and other things. It's kind of a sheer fabric, as folks like to say. You see through it. Comes in many colors. Probably too dense a weave. Probably too dense. And plus some of it may be colored, and plus it's often made of really nice material like silk and rayon, which is an awful expensive thing to put in the garden and probably won't hold up as well. That's an interesting question, but probably won't hold up as well, but just very expensive to put in the garden. I don't know if I'd do Tool, but it's kind of a tool-like fabric that we're looking for, usually made out of polyester or nylon, woven very kind of a reasonably open weave, but not too open because you want to be able to keep mosquitoes away, and flea beetles, and yellow margin beetles. Hey, we're going to be back. Cookie, sorry I missed you. I carry you home in a tool sack, book salad, and it's got two granny.
Now give me some of it. Now down in Louisiana, where the alligators grow so mean, there lived a girl that I swear to the world made the alligators look tame. Book salad, Annie.
Play it again. Mm-mm. Poke salad, Annie. Hey, I was commenting. That's that was the first record that I ever owned by myself. I got it when I was 5 years old. I think when I was probably 7 years old, I decided it was a little 45 RPM. I was out in the country somewhere, and there was a DJ there, and there was a radio shop, and they were giving away records, and I asked for one, and he gave me that record, little 45. I don't know why. You didn't think it was important. I thought it was pretty cool. I played it for a while and thought, what a cool song. Poke Salad Annie. When I was 7, I decided to put it in the oven and see what happened. Poke Salad Annie. Many memories. So listen, Gary, I hope you heard that. Poke salad. That's the picture you sent me, was a picture of poke salad. Poke salad. It's a cool thing. It's one of the South's most common weeds. Birds love it. It makes those beautiful purple berries. Do not eat the 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 berries. Birds can process them pretty well. I don't think people can. The leaves this time of year are, they're going to have concentrations of oxalic acid, which spinach has too. It's just that it's going to be in relatively high quantities, and therefore the plants are going to make you feel like when you eat them that you're eating crystals, like broken up crystals, like broken up pieces of glass. And it's just the oxalic acid. And it's not a good thing. You don't want to do it this time of year. But in spring, my great-grandmother and Leanna's folks, they all knew how to do it. They'd go out in the woods when the leaves were young, before they started stalking up, before it got too hot, and they would pick poke salad, and they would make poke salad greens. And it was the thing in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and Georgia and Northwest Florida. One of the great greens of spring. Important green. It isn't easy to make poke salad. You got to do it right. And so we don't talk about it that much because it does have the oxalic acid. You boiled it a couple of times. You boiled it, got rid of the water. You boiled it again, got rid of the water. And then you cooked it to get rid of the oxalic concentrations. If you got it young enough, you probably could avoid one of those boilings. But they're legendary. They're great greens. They really have a wonderful flavor. You just got to prepare them right. Poke salad, really good for wildlife. Really good for wildlife. All kind of wildlife use those things. And I think the plants are pretty. They get a little bug eaten this time of year because they're great for wildlife. Lots of things chew on them, and all that's fine. And they're great for quail and everything else. Poke salad. That's the picture. That's the picture. Much better than Tiny Tim. Indeed, indeed, indeed. So the question about the row covers, fall webworms and pecan trees, they're already there. It's pretty easy, and I'll remind of this, and some people have heard this before, but it's a good thing. If you can find a bamboo pole, it's kind of perfect. If you can't find a bamboo pole, find a lightweight stick. If you can find a fishing pole, if you can't find just good old bamboo, something that'll reach up into the upper, that'll reach to where those webworms are. And if it's a, you need to put a little hook or something that'll grab things on the tip. If it's a real bamboo pole, if you cut a piece of bamboo, it's going to have, you just cut off, you leave a little bit of the branch tips left at the tip, and you run it up that tree, and you hit the little nesting area where the tit is, and you just wrap it up, and you pull it down. You'll bring most of the caterpillars with it, you won't bring all, but that net is their protection. And that exposes them to birds and to other things, and they'll get predated. They'll get it up pretty good. And just pull that nest down. It may be that at certain times of day, I think it's a good question. I think probably, I'm going to think coming on, it's interesting. I'll have to think about it. What is the best time of day to do it? I'm thinking probably about 11 o'clock, maybe a good time. You want the caterpillars to be, and I'll have to think about that. I'll look that up. And it's really effective because you want it's nice to get as many caterpillars as you can, and they disperse from that netting, mostly I think at night. So if you wait until they're all assembled again, I think they're probably going to hunker in around noon and then disperse again in the late afternoons and in the early mornings. But probably around 11 o'clock is my guess. But just wrap them up, pull them down. That's it. Pretty good. Let's see. What else are we going to do here? Thomas sent me a picture of a sedge, and I'm trying to figure out which sedge it is, because it looks like there may be a couple of sedges. That's one of the problems I'm having. So I think you've got two sedges. One looks like a cypress, which is a nut sedge, and the other one looks like some kind of rush, one of the Rhynchospores or something. I can't quite tell. But there's a couple of sedges there. And sedges are really, really common. And they're kind of, what is a sedge? It's not a grass, even though we give the common name, we call some types of grasses sedges, like we talk about broom sedge or broom sage, which is a grass. But sedges are kind of halfway between grasses and lilies, I is the way I think of it in my simple-minded sort of way. They're a little more they're a little different than grasses. They invade lawns, but there are many species. One of the interesting things, I know you don't care about diversity. I know you don't care about how important the Gulf Coast is to the rest of the world. But if you did, you'd be interested to know that Mobile County is probably the center of sedge diversity in the United States, or maybe one other county along the Gulf Coast. So it's Gulf Coast counties and huge sedge diversity, incredible sedge diversities along the Gulf Coast and throughout Alabama and Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, but particularly along the Gulf Coast. I mean, gosh, I there's so many to remember. There's so many to know, and they're all so interesting. But they're really cool plants. And they're I wish, you know, one of the ways you have to distinguish sedges is by looking at the nutlets. There's little nutlets in those flowers, and sometimes you have to look at them with a magnifying glass, and then you can figure out which one they are. Sometimes you can tell by looking at the plant broadly, and if more of that plant were in focus, or if it was a more detail, I could probably give you a little better assessment. I'm going to work on it a little bit over the break, but what you're looking at is a couple of varieties of sedge, different genera, different genuses, and different species. Really interesting. Really interesting. All right. So, Steve in West Mobile has got an easier one to identify to species. They may have changed the genus, but it's Phyllanthus, basically. Phyllanthus, which means leaf flower. Phyla, phylo, leaf. Anthus, meaning flower. Phyllanthus. And then I'm going to give you the species name, and I'll let you figure out what it's named for. Urinaria. Phyllanthus. Urinaria. Chamber bitters, they used to call it, because I think the idea was it grew where the chamber pot got thrown. And it has many names. Leaf flower. People who don't know what else to call it baby mimosa. It's not a mimosa. It's not a tree. It's not even related to mimosa at all. Not even close. It has a fern-like leaf, Phyllanthus. And it's gripeweed. There you go. That's a name we hear a lot for this plant. It's a little bit of a issue in lawns this time of year. One of the things that I think reduces the level, there are two things that Phyllanthus needs: sunlight, lots of sunlight. So if the grass is tall enough and healthy enough, usually you don't have a big problem with Phyllanthus coming up. And so if you see ground through your grass stems, if you can see the dirt underneath your grass stems, you're mowing it a little too close. You're mowing it too close. And I think, I could be wrong, but my guess is you're mowing a little close. And then if you're watering all the time, you're going to have a big problem with Phyllanthus. So there it is. Gripeweed. Let's start there. Let's call it gripeweed. Oh, David, that gagutsa looks beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Hey, we're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. Sharon, I'm coming. Hold on.
Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun...
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Mm. So, Sharon, let's tackle this thing. Let's tackle this issue. Sharon sent me some pictures.
Okay. I noticed my longleaf pine was looking badly. And so I looked closer, and I saw those bugs on it, and I went to the computer, and I thought they were red-headed pine sawflies. And so it said use insecticidal soap and wash them off, which I did. But then I thought, well, aren't they just going to go down into the dirt and make more bugs? I'm wondering if I should have used something to kill them.
Yeah, so you got it. You got sawflies. I'm not sure which one. It may be the red-headed sawfly. Sawflies are kind of interesting bugs. They usually affect trees alone. They look like caterpillars, like moth caterpillars. But, you know, it took me years to figure this out. To my surprise, they're not caterpillars at all. I think they're actually wasp. They're actually the larvae of a kind of weird wasp. Now, it's not a stinging wasp. The wasp looks more like a regular old housefly than a wasp. But it's a weird little thing, sawfly. And there's lots of sawflies out there, various species. I think you probably have the common one, which I think is red-headed pine sawfly. It's rare that sawflies do enough damage to actually harm a tree. They show up year to year. It's something that the trees learn to live with, and so, you know, it's not a big deal. I don't think that I think that unless they're well fed, they're not going to develop into adults. So knocking them off the tree and making sure they don't get back on it is probably simply enough to keep them from turning into healthy adults. So you kind of broke that cycle that way, and I think that's fine. And there'll be lots of things in the ground, including ants and other things, that'll love to eat those larvae, even if they're still alive. So I think you're okay. I think that's generally the way to deal with sawfly larvae. Now, if you really want to make sure, one of the things you can do is take a tarp or something and wrap it around the tree like a Christmas skirt, and shake the tree or brush the tree. You call them brooms. Lord have mercy. You take a broom and you sweep the tree of those sawfly larvae. That's one way to do it. And they'll all drop down there, and then you can individually dispose of each one. You can torture them if you like, but I wouldn't do that. I mean, they're okay. they're just sort of making a living like the rest of us. And so there it is, sawfly larvae. I think you're okay. And that's exactly what's affecting your pine. I do see it on longleaf occasionally. And your tree looks pretty good. I would, what else? It looks, there's a little bit of gunk around the, yeah, I guess that's their nesting. But, you know, I think you've done okay. And take a, I wouldn't even worry about soap. That's kind of weird. You probably don't need that. You could just sweep them off or take a hose and just hose them off. In all likelihood, most of them are not going to find the tree again. And if you want to make sure, so just sawfly larvae. And I think you're
wonderful.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hey, bye-bye.
Yes, ma'am. So, I'm being asked about the citrus issue, and David is helping me, and we're gonna figure it out. You know, I'm gonna let everybody figure out what it is they're gonna do in this coming week, and then I'll report, because I'm not gonna try to guess. And I shouldn't try to guess. I don't want to try to guess. And I'm going to come back this next week and talk to a lot of folks, let it all settle out, and then we'll talk about the citrus problem. There's going to be a lot of effort here. You're going to hear a lot more about it, I suspect. I hope we can stop it dead in its tracks. I've got to, you know, what happens is going to depend a lot on the state and what happens to the rest of citrus. Should you buy citrus right now? I don't know. I certainly, if I saw citrus available, I'd think twice. If I always think twice before I buy citrus from the big box stores like Home Depot or Lowe's, because in all likelihood, it's going to be a citrus that's very vulnerable to both. And two, it's probably a citrus that's not going to do that well here because they don't give a hoot what grows in Mobile. They only care about trying to fool you into buying a plant that they sell the same citrus everywhere they sell citrus. So I don't know. I would be very suspicious right now about buying from a big box store, but not because it necessarily carried disease. I think they're probably as sanitary as anybody where diseases are concerned, but just probably not a great thing. Plus, it's a terrible time to buy citrus. Do not buy citrus now. Let me start over again. Don't buy citrus now. Just don't. If there were no diseases, it would be a terrible time of year to buy citrus. Let's let this thing filter through. Let's stick with what we got. Let's talk about it. We're going to talk about citrus. Let's don't import citrus from other places. If you're bringing citrus in now, you've really made a lot of mistakes. But we'll talk more about it. We'll come up with some plans. David, I'm going to talk more with you about it, and we're going to come up with some plans for next week. Citrus, we always had a citrus paradise. I said that. We had to be very careful about it. We had to be very careful about it, and we all weren't always. Rodney says his grandmother told him to, that's how you get rid of fall webworms, is to use bamboo. Test the bamboo first. Yes, that's probably a good idea. But most bamboo will work. Just because the web's strong, just twist it, just poke it up in there and twist it around. It's really cool. Rodney says, and I hadn't thought about this, but it probably is mostly true. If you twist it enough, it's actually going to crush the worms, and I think it probably will. So they're kind of crushed by the strength of their own web. And that's an interesting thing that Rodney points out. I like that idea. There'll still be some alive when you pull it down. Still be some that didn't get in the nest. But without that nest, without that home base, without that protection, they're not going to survive long in the tree and not going to do a lot of damage. Not going to do a lot of damage at all. Tony Joe White. So, poke salad, Annie. We should talk about Tony Joe White. I think it was Tony Joe White, who's 45, I had, that I cooked in the oven when I was 7 years old. Ooh. Can you imagine? But, you know, I was seven. Wanted to see. What does that make me, that I cooked at 45 in the oven? Hey, we're going to be back. We got lots of cool things. Tony Joe White, poke salad, Annie. That was him singing. Yeah, that would have been cool to see the place. It would see with Jethro Tull and Spirit. That would have been cool. Hey, we're going to be back. Give us a call.
Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right around all the seven.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Listen, I think we got a little moment here, and I want to talk about, we talked about how to get ready, how to get a jump on fall. And let me emphasize again, folks, if you ain't discovered how easy it is to garden in fall and winter and spring in Alabama, on the Gulf Coast, in Mississippi, in Florida, you've missed it. It's so easy. And we had this discussion, somehow we got into this last week, I can't even remember how. But the question was, you know, can't grow kale. Well, yeah, we can grow kale. We can grow kale for longer in Alabama than you can grow it anywhere else. It's great, but you can only grow it during the winter. Lettuce. You don't want to plant lettuce in spring, folks. Do not plant lettuce in spring. It's a waste of time. Cilantro. Incredible when it's planted this time of year because the days are getting shorter. It won't go to seed. It's amazing. It's a miracle. Parsley. Man, parsley is the winter vegetable. It is so incredible. Oh, if you ain't made parsley pesto, you don't understand. Carrots, collards, cabbage, broccoli, beets, arugula, mustard, greens. It goes on. Turnips. Goes on and on and on and on. There's so many great things you can grow during winter because they're winter hardy. They're great. But you got to get started now. And the reason I'm just going to repeat, the reason you get started now is because the only downside to winter is that really that the days get shorter. It doesn't get cold enough to freeze the ground. The plants will keep growing, but the days are getting shorter. There's less photosynthesis. You don't know that plants are green. Did you notice that plants are green? I don't know if you've ever noticed, but plants are green, and there's a reason they're green. And the reason they're green is because they do photosynthesis. That's how they get their energy. It ain't a hobby. It's not just a hobby, photosynthesis. It's the way plants make a living. That's it. It ain't the fertilizer. That's grease for the wheels that turn the photosynthetic process. It's photosynthesis. They got to have sunlight. Everything you eat, it's got to have sunlight. Everything you eat out of the garden, got to have sunlight. And so when the days get shorter, there's not as much sunlight. That's the downside. But there's enough. There's just enough. And the farther south you get, the more sunlight there is in the middle of winter. It's one of the reasons why we can do it. Harder, much harder to do it in Maine, for example, because the days are really short up there. And there's just not enough sunlight, even if the temperatures were good. Here we got enough sunlight, but not enough to really induce flowering very well and to encourage new growth. So you're going to see a slowdown in growth from about mid-November on. Now, that's not a big deal as long as you're starting now, because they will have developed all their energy. The plants will be strong. They're going to have a ton of carbohydrate storage that they'll be ready to flower. So you got to get things like broccoli and cabbages and carrots started as soon as you can. But particularly right now, hope you got that list. There's a bunch of them. You know, I don't know how to start. I mean, but right now, here's the ones that I would really focus on the Gulf Coast. You got to start broccoli right away. And in North Alabama, you really better get it started. Broccoli, you got to get it started right away. You got to get your cabbage started right away from seeds. You want to go ahead and get your collards started right now from seed. Get them started now in pots from seed as soon as you can. Wouldn't have hurt to start them even a little bit earlier. Parsley. You got to start them right now from seeds in pots. So these are the kinds of things that you really want to get. Start them in pots. And one of the reasons is you want these to be big, strapping plants so that you can really pick them hard. Cabbages take a long time to head up. You know, you got to have plenty of energy for them to head up. They need to be hitting that heading up season just right. Broccoli, they're flowers. You're eating the flowers. And so you got to have plenty of time for those broccoli to start making flowers. That's why we start them now. Start them in pots. Start them in containers. This is kind of your last chance. Carrots, if you're in North Alabama, you definitely want to get carrots in the ground right away. I would say on the Gulf Coast, you know, you could try carrots right now. You could wait a week or two. You can go ahead and order some, piddle around with it, figure it out. But carrots go into the ground. And that's why I talked about the netting. Because if you're going to start your carrots or your beets, and I think beets probably could work with beets too, that netting can really help with those getting those plants started. Both beets and carrots are going to need plenty of moisture. Moisture is going to be less reliable in late August and September, because you're not going to get those everyday rain showers. So you're going to want to wet the ground pretty good. You're probably going to want to add a little bit of shade, and we talked about how to do that with pine needles. All that's good. Is that good? Lettuce. I didn't talk about lettuce. I mean, I was insulting towards lettuce the other day. And you should just... I apologize. I apologize to lettuce. A lot of lettuce is pretty insipid. Oh, I didn't mean to say that again, but it is. It's just insipid. And it's just like it's a texture. Or it's a color that you add to your salad, and that's fine. But, you know, I had some really good lettuce the other day. It was really delicious, and I thought, you know, this is why people grow lettuce. It was good. It was very good. It's at a nice restaurant. They did a really good job. It was great. They know how to pick their produce. It didn't come from a hydroponics place. Had flavor. Lettuce can be really good when you grow it in your garden. If you're going to grow lettuce, you want to get it going for winter. I think it's early for lettuce for the Gulf Coast. Probably early even for North Alabama, because lettuce grows very fast. Lettuce grows very fast. Arugula you could wait on, because arugula grows very fast. Mustard greens, that's a tough one. I think for the most part I would wait a little while to sow my mustard greens. I did not wait, and let me emphasize, since somebody asked, I did not wait on my radishes. Radishes, there is no reason not to plant radish. Let me just put that in a positive light. You better plant those radishes right away, or you're in trouble. Because radishes are great. Now, we're not talking about the little bitty baby radishes that they serve in restaurants. Those are spring radishes. We're talking about the winter radishes. We're talking about the big radishes. We're talking about radishes that can get 3 feet long, though I don't think they're particularly all that good, but they're interesting. We're talking about the winter radishes, and there's a bunch of varieties out there. You should start trying them. Watermelon radish, Chinese rose. Oh, the beautiful radishes, the violet-colored radishes, the Korean radishes, they're all great. They're winter radishes, and they do really well. And you can start sowing them now. They never do well in spring. They never do well from a spring planting, but now they come up well during this time of year. The foliage doesn't seem to... Everybody seems to ignore the foliage. The bugs seem to ignore the foliage. So you could sow them. They're so easy, and they're so good. And you can use those radishes. You can use the radish greens. You're going to use the radish greens for cooking. The radish greens are delicious, particularly in fall. And the roots are delicious. I mean, you find all kind of uses for the roots. If you find a radish that you had a radish that was hot, and you're one of those folks, I don't like hot things. Well, that's okay. Here's what you do. You cut your radish up, let it sit for a while, and the heat dissipates. That's an advantage and a disadvantage. If you like the heat, you got to eat the radishes fresh when you cut them up. But the heat dissipates when you cut them up, and they're quite good. We use them, you know, instead of crackers. They're really great. Oh, man, what a great thing. A little bit of cheese. They're kind of great for just tasting things. Radishes for a beer tasting. That's a thing, you know. It's a big thing. I didn't make that up. We're going to be back. Give us a call.
There's a fly in the window, a dog in the yard, and the years since I saw you. There's a trunk in the corner, I keep all my letters, my bills, and demands I keep too.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood. Slowly I become one with the mud.
But if I can swim out the
yeah, okay. Here we go. You know, I could listen to Poke Salad Annie at nearly every break. I don't think I'd get tired of it. At least Well, maybe I would. But, you know, cool thing. Some questions here coming up. I hope that if you don't understand what you're supposed to do about fall gardening, you call me because it's important. It's the time. This is the time to do it. August is late August, particularly on the Gulf Coast. Throughout Alabama, it's one of the most important planting seasons. I don't mean to suggest that you shouldn't be planting things in March or February or early January. All those are important planting times. April is kind of a good planting time for things like okra and the eggplants. But the truth is, fall really is the time when I plant more things in fall than any other time of year. And to do that, to be successful at it, you really got to start in August. You got to start not only thinking about it, but actually doing some planting. And you better order some garlic. I'll tell you, if you're going to grow garlic, the garlic's going to sell out. You got to do it fast. And we can talk about your garlic and how to grow it and all that, but you got to get it. I will tell you, if you're going to order garlic, I should tell you now, you need to order garlic that is, if you're on the Gulf Coast, you really want garlic that develops in early May. And that can be harvested in early May before or mid-May or late May at the latest, before the rains start. And that means basically you're going to go with turban garlic, which mostly comes from China. Turban garlic, it's the one that does best on the Gulf Coast. As you move farther north, where rainfall may be less intense in summer sometimes, you can try other varieties, but those turban garlics are the best. The turban garlics are the best. Some will not get enough winter chilling. Turban garlics, that's what you're looking for. Fillory Farms, there's some other places that sell garlic, and I'm looking at them as well and trying to evaluate their stuff, but that's good. So a lot of things to do. If you've got any questions about what to do, you just feel free to call me, because it's an important thing. It's an important time of year. And I wish that, you know, I wish that my haranguing were not necessary. I wish you all were haranguing me about it. You know, well, why are you sitting there talking on the radio when you could be out planting your garden? Well, that's a great question. You don't need me. I'm going to go plant my garden. And in fact, I don't want you to need me. I want you to understand where you are. I want you to take advantage of these seasons. So let's do that. Did I give them all? God, arugula, broccoli, beets, cilantro, cabbage, collards, carrots. See what I'm saying? Whole bunch of them. Fava beans. About October for fava beans. What am I going to miss? You know, the list goes on and on. Radishes, please do the radishes. Please think about lettuces. Parsley, man, you got to think about parsley now. Kale, of course kale. Mustards. Chinese cabbages and all the pak choys. This is the time of year to do it. They require some special thought. The pak choys, you really need to cover with the netting if you're going to put them out. Call me if you've got questions about what to plant in fall. I want to help. I want it to be the kind of thing we all know, that we all respond to. So a picture here, a couple of pictures. Carol in Bay Minette sent me a beautiful picture of a moth. Now, what kind of moth is it, Carol? I don't know. But, you know, here's an interesting thing. And, Carol, I want you to do this. I want you to go on the Internet. And there's some moth and butterfly identification pages. And I just want you to look through those pages. You're going to get fascinated by the beauty of moths. They're absolutely stunning. And there's so many different kinds. And you're going to say, God, I never knew this. And they're beautiful and they're cool. And I don't know which one that one is. But, you know, you're going to be able to figure that one out as well as I can. So I want you to go on. I want you to look to see if you see a picture of that moth and report back to us next week on which moth it was. And tell me everything you could discover about that moth, what it eats, what the caterpillar looks like, if you can find that. Is it rare? Is it common? Where does it... It's a moth. And you'll be able to identify it on the internet. It's really cool. I don't know which one it is, honestly. I won't have to... There's just hundreds of them. But you'll have so much fun browsing through. And I may even browse through myself. But I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm going to let you tell me what it is. Because I don't know. How's that? I don't know. I don't know moths as well as I know things, but they're so cool. This is a beautiful picture of a pine forest. I'm trying to think why Dan wants me to know about it, but it is beautiful. It's a beautiful place. I see in the background, well, I see longleaf, it looks like. And I see some Quercus geminata. Ooh. There's some Quercus geminata in there. There's magnolia, a little off-site. Looks to me like a magnolia that probably shouldn't be there, which indicates it was kind of invaded. How do magnolia trees do in fire? Not well. And that's good. They are not a fire-resistant species. They have a thin bark. And when we were restoring the longleaf area at the Mobile Botanical Gardens, there were so many magnolias that had come in. And the only reason they came in was because it had been fire suppressed. We had suppressed the natural element of a longleaf system. And so these magnolias could come in. You know, one of the things I say about live oaks, the big live oaks, not sand live oaks, not Quercus geminata, but the big live oaks that are in people's yards and magnolias, is that they're more abundant now than they've ever been, probably in ever, because we encouraged them to grow in places they didn't normally grow. We did that by several means. It's not like, and quite honestly, as nice as magnolias are, and I recommend them for people's yards, they're nice, but the woods don't need more magnolias. They got plenty of, particularly the evergreen magnolia, and we don't have as many of those evergreen magnolias growing in the right places. They usually grow in moister areas, on deep rich soils, not too flooded, but occasional flood, but not too much. You know, they used magnolias, the old magnolias, on those great sites. They used them as timber trees. I mean, they were, a lot of what was sold as poplar was, I think, magnolia. They were gigantic. They were huge. But they're not going to get gigantic in that longleaf site. They're going to get dumpy, and they're going to shade out everything underneath them. They're going to have very little value there to themselves or to nature. And so fire will weed them out. And that's okay. And I don't know that you need to cut it out at that point. It's been limbed up already by fire. Fire's going to keep hitting that bark. It's going to keep getting a little rougher and rougher as if there's more fire there. As long as there's fire there, you're okay. I do see some weeds coming in like privet and some other things. But where is that, Dan? It's a good, cool thing. Why do they plant Hollywood by the outhouse? I don't know the answer to that question. Do they plant holly trees by the outhouse? I don't know. That's not one I've heard of. Maybe that's an accident. Hollyhocks. Oh. Hollyhocks. The leaves? You ever seen a hollyhock leaf? Could be one thing. They kind of have a little bit of fragrance. They're pretty. Maybe people think the outhouses need to be augmented by pretty, you know? sorry, good. I was going to worry about the Hollywood thing. But hollyhocks, yeah. You know, I have a hard time with hollyhocks, even planting them in fall. I southern seed, a southern exposure seed, you know, up in Virginia, I think the hollyhocks do better. I've never had great success with hollyhocks in Alabama. I'll be truthful. Oh, but this is great music. So I can forget about my lack of success with hollyhocks and listen to Bambula.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, let's run through this real quick. So we've got a picture I don't know who sent it to me, but a lady I know has this deciduous shrub. The cut line beneath the picture says, a lady I know has this deciduous shrub. It gets is about 8 feet tall. It has pinkish white flowers. Do you know this plant? Wonder if anybody else can guess from just that information. And I have a picture of the leaves. I don't have a picture of the flowers, but the flowers are pretty big. They're big, aren't they, huh? Well, it's a hibiscus. It's one of the Asian hibiscus, and it incredibly has earned the name Confederate Rose, which is interesting. And so it's planted at Confederate cemeteries, even though it's an Asian. It's funny, isn't it? There's an irony in that. I hope they're rolling over in their graves. I hope they sleep uncomfortably. It's named for, as nearly as I can tell, the reason it got the name Confederate Rose. It's not a rose at all. There was a mystique about the rose after the Civil War, which is hard to explain. This one was called. But the reason it's called Confederate Rose is because, as nearly as I can tell, is because of the Malaysian Confederacy. I think. Because it has nothing to do with the American Confederacy or the Southern Confederacy, which I guess wasn't purely American. But it's funny. But that's what it is, a hibiscus. It's a hibiscus. It's a nice hibiscus. It's a fun hibiscus. It's a deciduous hibiscus. It gets big, has lots of funny names. That's what it is. So Tony says that, talking about planting trees around outhouses and pokeweed and whatever else, that people in the country always had a chinaberry tree in the yard to keep away fleas. Yeah, you know, I it's a very interesting thing. So the fruits of chinaberry have been recommended as an insecticide. Does it work on fleas? I wouldn't use it as my first defense. But there is a bit of truth to it. There is a bit of truth because the fruits and maybe the foliage have been recommended. You know, one of the other things is I see people putting the fruits in bags and putting it in their drawers. Not the drawers you wear, but the drawers you open. Putting it in their drawers. The ones that you open, you know, in a chest to discourage bugs there. And maybe that works. I don't know. But maybe put it in cabinets could work. I don't know. But it does have insecticidal properties. It's related to what's that other tree that people are using a lot now? I'll think of it. But it's several trees in that family have insecticidal properties. And there's a degree to which it works. And I think that's how the flea thing got started. Do I think chinaberry trees are going to eliminate fleas? Nah. I don't think so. But any rate, there's that. That's the best explanation I have for that. Let's see. Did we miss somebody? Marie, is Marie still there? We almost missed Marie. Are you still there, Marie?
I am, and I've got several
Marie,
questions
you are,
for you.
Yeah, you're so good for holding on. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. I enjoy your show. I think everybody I know does. On the mosquito netting, there's no place locally that you know of that I always like to buy local if I can, Bill. And there's no place locally that you know of that carries it.
No.
Okay.
And maybe we ought to encourage some of the local nurseries to carry it. They're probably reluctant to get things like that in until there is a clear demand for it. No, I do not know of a local place that sells it. You're certainly not going to find it at Lowe's or Home Depot. You might call, but I don't think so. I will say that, no, I don't think so. I don't think you're going to find it.
Okay.
So that's why, and it's, you know, there are some people that sell, and you might find at some places certain types of insect netting, but if it's not fairly an open weave, I'd be very careful about it. It tends to tear easily, or it tends to get too hot. So, but that's why I'm recommending the one I am. And I don't know of a place locally that sells it.
Okay.
It's possible, but I doubt it.
The hardware stores used to carry it years ago, but I haven't been able to find any of it in a long time,
right.
You know. So I just thought I'd ask that.
That's right.
The
and so
I'd like to know from you, and I know you would know it. Is I know that they have a local gardening thing somewhere in Midtown that everybody goes together and they help to put a garden together for people down there that either need or want the fresh vegetables. Do you by chance know where that is? I'd like to be able to go talk to them and see about starting one out here in West Mobile.
Well, there are several places that come and go, and I don't know which ones are operating right now.
Okay.
There was one that the Methodist Church, both of the Methodist churches in Midtown had gardens at one time. The Presbyterian Church in Midtown has a big garden, and I think they're pretty. That's probably pretty much still in operation, and they may be able to help.
Okay.
But mostly there seem to be associated with churches. And those of you who know which churches are still doing this, you might help us here, Marie and me, by telling us which ones.
And Bill, I heard you say something about hollyhocks. I've never seen one growing here. And when I grew up, they were a very prominent thing in other places. Since you had trouble growing them, do you think that maybe it's a problem with them doing well here?
Yeah, I mean, here's what they're kind of you would kind of I believe you would have to grow them as biennials, which means are overwintering annuals is what I'm going to call them. So what I would do is if I were going to grow hollyhocks, and somebody else should try it because you know I screw up. Ain't nothing special about my ability to grow things. I have to work at it. And I decided I worked at hollyhocks hard enough. I gave up.
Because
hollyhocks weren't that important and because I didn't have an outhouse. And so I didn't need hollyhocks by the outhouse. At least I don't have one anymore. So, yeah, but you'd want to sow them in fall, and you want to sow about right now, maybe a little later on the Gulf Coast. One of the problems I found was that rust diseases really, really hit a lot of hollyhocks hard.
Wow.
And so when I would get them through the winter, which they did pretty well, it was really pleased and thought, man, I got this thing figured out. And then March or April, the rust diseases just hit them like crazy. Bam. Boom. And they were ugly. They were terrible. And I decided, this ain't worth it. Now, it may be that, and this happened for a couple of years in a row, and I just decided, this ain't going to work. But it may be that not every garden has the rust disease problems. It may be there are varieties of hollyhocks that you're going to discover that don't, that aren't as subject to rust, to the rust, to the foliar diseases. And in fact, there are some of them out there. It's just that I think they're going to be the ones that are resistant to the rust diseases also seem to be less adapted to our climate. So I haven't figured hollyhocks out. And that may be why you don't see them as much along the Gulf Coast. You know, there are lots of overwintering flowers, and we should talk more about those, and I will, and you know, lots of them that you can grow as biennials, and they'll bloom in spring. One of them, of course, that I talk about all the time are sweet peas, and that's kind of the thing, is plant those on the Gulf Coast in this time of year, maybe a little later, and in September, let them come on up, and let them, they'll kind of sit there quietly through the winter, putting roots down and getting well established, and the first warm days in February, they're going to jump up, and they'll bloom really well. You plant them in spring, and they don't do well at all, but they do really well planted in fall. But hollyhocks didn't work that way for me.
No, they didn't for me either. I had always thought they were real nice background, you know, up against a building or something, and with plants in front of them. But I couldn't get them to do here.
Yeah, yeah. Did you try planting in fall, Marie?
I tried planting them in fall. I tried planting them in the summer. And I tried planting them in the spring. And
Marie,
just didn't do good.
You make me feel okay. You make me feel like
I'm
okay.
Glad. I've got one more question for you, Bill. And if it's out of line, please just say, we're not going to go there. But, you know, this is the political season is starting to come in, and everybody's got all this stuff up about it and who we could do something with and all. Are there any people that are running that you know of that support the botanical garden?
Oh, boy.
I know.
You should ask them. You should ask them, because that's an important question. And, you know, all you got to do is just ask. All you got to do is send an email into each of them and say, you know, it's important to me that you support the botanical gardens. Do you do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's everything they're saying that they're going to do downtown and around Mobile. I found it very interesting that was one of the things that wasn't mentioned. We're not going to say by who or anything, but that wasn't mentioned. And yet, if they're going to spend all these billions of dollars, you would think that they would want to spend some of it there and have our city be as beautiful as it possibly can be, because we're almost legendary as to how well we can grow things.
That's right. That's except for hollyhocks.
Yeah, right. Forget those hollyhocks.
Marie, send them a letter. Send them a letter. We got to take a break, but send them a letter. Send them an email. Let them know.
I will. Oh, I will. I intended to write the letter, but I figured if anybody would know, you would. And I didn't know if you'd be willing to mention anything, but that's why I said it the way I did, so I didn't put you on the spot.
Yeah.
I will start writing the letters tomorrow.
Marie, thank you.
Thank you, and you do well, and take good care.
Thank you. Hey, we're going to be back.
Just across.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Bum, bum, ba-da, ba-da, bum, 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 ba-da, bum.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. The jasmine is her.
Okay, listen, let's get started because we don't have a lot of time. I want to get to some things. Jim in Georgetown raised an interesting question about fire. You know, a lot of people used to burn their gardens in usually in February. But it would depend on when you know, and there's a lot of factors involved. It can help. It can get rid of diseases. You have to be very careful. You don't burn your house down. I wouldn't do it in a suburb. The fire department will be there unless you do it on Joe Kane Day. Don't say I said that. You want to be careful about fire, but it can work. It can do some wonderful things. You know, Jim, with rattlesnake weed, it's going to be... The key with rattlesnake weed is it actually hadn't developed any root. It doesn't develop any storage roots over winter. It's already used its storage roots to put up leaves for winter, and those storage roots kind of dissipate. So it's a terrible time to try to harvest rattlesnake weed, which is delicious. A delicacy, let's put it that way. And it because there's not much in the way of any storage roots there during winter because it's put all of its energy into producing foliage. It tends to produce the storage roots coming up on summer. So the key is simply to keep it from doing any photosynthesis. And so the fire will briefly keep it from doing any photosynthesis, and it's one effective. It'll probably come back up again from whatever's left underneath the soil, maybe. But that second, if you can cut that second thing down, it won't have any energy left. It'll have used up all of its energy. So the secret to rattlesnake weed, if you don't want it, is to weed it twice, maybe thrice in winter. Once, twice, maybe thrice in winter. It'll get rid of it because it doesn't have any storage system left. So there it is. David sent me a message saying that there is a local, and I'm sorry, some people don't let me know, and that's okay. There's a local Urban Growers Association with some people I know, Carol and Pat. They're putting this together, the MobileUrbanGrowers.org. If they ought to maybe call in someday, we'll talk about what they're doing. The MobileUrbanGrowers.org. MobileUrbanGrowers, one word, .org. So they're putting together all of these gardens, a lot of them that I talked about, into a network, and that's a great thing. That's a good thing. I hope they're successful. It is a very good thing. Let's see here. Chris, let's talk about those sable palms. You still there? Chris, I'm sorry I missed you. Let me talk about sable palms briefly and transplanting them. Young sable palms cannot... This is the exact opposite of everything else that I say, but these palms are different, and I'll tell you why. Young sable palms cannot be transplanted. They are very difficult to transplant, and the success is like 1% or less. And the reason for that, whereas older sable palms, weirdly enough, sable palms 4, 6, 8 feet tall, actually transplant really well. Really well. So, Chris, you there? Yeah. So, tell me about transplanting.
Why do the small ones not want to take?
Okay, good. So that's exactly where we were in the conversation.
Right.
Palms, unlike trees, they have a bulb, particularly
right.
Sable palms.
They have a bulb.
Yeah. And they don't develop that bulb until they're older. So they have very little capability, and that bulb is a storage thing that allows them to reproduce the roots. And so if you transplant them before they have developed the bulb, they can't reproduce the roots.
Gotcha.
Yep. That's it. And so one of the other things about palms, I would say, and particularly sables, sable, whatever, is that I would not try to transplant them this time of year. Unlike most trees, palms are different. I would transplant them in spring when the ground has begun to warm. And that's a better time. Older trees in spring when the ground has begun to warm. This time of year, probably a little late.
Okay. Appreciate it, man.
All right, Chris. Yeah, isn't that funky? Now, listen. Anybody who heard that, I want you to think about it carefully. I don't want you to take it too far. Most plants like being transplanted in late fall and winter. That's the preference in throughout Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Palms are different. Citrus are different. And they're different in part because they're subtropical and because they don't develop roots until the ground warms. It's just the way it is. So I wouldn't transplant them this time of year. You do it, generally do it. You could start in March, April, May, June, great time. Give them plenty of time to get those roots established. And there's some funky things, that funky rules with palms that don't apply to other trees, and you just have to think about them a little bit different. A little bit different. David, I just keep looking at this Creole Italian baked gagoozza. It's Italian sausage, breadcrumbs, Parmesan cheese on the gagoozza. Now, can you taste the gagoozza? But it looks delicious. It looks absolutely delicious. I'm loving it. It's a beautiful thing. So we only got a little bit of time, but let me just say, pinto palm plant in spring. Transplant when it's a little bigger. Let me just say that it's the time for planting. Let me remind you, it's the time for planting. Get it started. I gave you a list of things. I hope you heard me. If you didn't hear me, you call me back next week and we'll figure it out. But there, look, I wonder if I can do the alphabet real quickly. Arugula, broccoli, beets. Oh, I could say Brussels sprouts, but don't do Brussels sprouts if you live near the coast. It's going to be hard, I promise. Don't waste your time with Brussels sprouts. Let's get on to the C's. Let's do collards, and let's do kale, starts with a K. Let's do collards, and cabbage, and carrots, and cilantro. Oh, I can never get to the Z's. It's just, there's so many. Get your parsley ready, folks. Get it done. It's time. We're going to be back next week.